That's right, friends and family. We have an entire episode of Dadages for you today based upon the art of insubordination. We continue our discussion of one of my dad's favorite dadages, to thine own self be true. But we're really kicking it up a notch today and introducing a special guest to the Dadages friends and family, Todd Cashton.
You know, when I was your age, go ask your mother. I know you don't like it. It builds character. How many times do I have to tell you? I'm not just talking to hear my own voice.
Hello, listener, and welcome to Dadages. I'm your host, Chad Hagel. And if you are looking for some fatherly wisdom for your career, your family, or any other aspect of your life, then you've come to the right place. If you want to learn more about Dadages, find additional content, submit questions, or feedback to me, visit dadages.com. Thanks for being here. And before you listen to our podcast, please listen to your father. Todd wrote the book on insubordination. No, I mean literally, Todd wrote the book, The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. Some of you may think you have already perfected the art of insubordination, but I challenge you on that. I bet you still have a thing or two to learn from Todd. Or for you insubordinates out there, Dr. Cashton. Todd, welcome to Dadages.
Hey, so good to be here.
Yeah, so let's provide a bit more of your background to the Dadages friends and family. Is it true that you hold a master's in insubordination and a doctorate in dissent, or did my producers get that wrong?
Yeah, it's a long history. I mean, you go back to grade school where I'd be in a chemistry class and I was a budding writer and I would ask the teacher of like, hey, can I read this poem? And I used to include commercial advertisements in my poems. And then it was one of those things that I was a nerdy kid, but once you kind of had this platform to talk about other people, people would beg me in the lunchroom, like, hey, can you include my name in a cool commercial? Like, make me the bully or the protagonist. And so I've been doing this since preteen years.
That's great. And obviously inspiring others and bringing them along for the ride.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people who have great talents and gifts that are overshadowed by aggressive, narcissistic characters the whole purpose of this mission is, if you lack power and status, how can you be persuasive?
Yeah, yeah. And so getting real and honest here, your day job, in addition to being a dissenter, is you're actually a shaper of young minds. You're a professor at George Mason University. And let me get a couple of these stats right. You've been published in over 225 articles. Your work has been cited over 47,000 times. You've written several books now, and your research is featured regularly in The Atlantic, Harvard Business Review, The New York Times, NPR, Fast Company, and Time Magazine. That doesn't strike me as someone who's insubordinate or a dissenter. How do you balance this level of influence and exposure that you have in, let's call it, the mainstream, with the notion of being a career-long insubordinate?
That is a great question. I think one of the important things is to realize, and this is part of how to be persuasive, is what are the objectives and motivations of the people that you're trying to move? And so when you get these mainstream outlets like Harvard Business Review, okay, they want something to, they've been talking about leadership, time immortal, about the same topics, about mindfulness and perspective taking and empathy. So when I create a query to Harvard Business Review, I say, listen, I've read your articles. I know your stuff. You know what's the missing thing you haven't been talking about? You have been talking about perspective getting before perspective taking. And I'm going to kind of walk you through and your readers of what to do this. And so you use the left of center approach in our work and our science and our thinking, but you tie it to the mainstream edifice that gets them the money and the attention and every metric that they care about.
Yes, you anchor it in what is commonplace or relevant or comfortable for them, perhaps. And then you use that as a launching off point to go in a different direction that's innovative.
Yeah, it's like a police interrogation. You know, if you watch these documentaries, the last one I watched, I think, was Lover, Stalker, Killer, a documentary on Netflix. Yeah. And one of the age-old strategies of police investigations is you lead the leading suspect to think that you have the same perspective as them. You think they're in the right. They're actually the victim. And people's egos are so fragile. They're so excited to get validation that they share information because they think that you are basically allies in this venture against somebody else. And so thinking about the whole world is a game except for close friends and families. Enjoy it, have fun, make an impact, and don't interfere with the well-being of other people. And that's a good platform for principled rebels.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of platforms, you've delivered this message into some pretty impressive and established organizations as well. The list that I saw is Microsoft, Mercedes-Benz, Prudential, and then even to the World Bank and the U.S. Department of Defense. Without sharing any classified information and getting all of us in trouble, can you just give us some insight into the types of topics that you talk about when you go to meet with these companies and how you deliver that message in a corporate setting?
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you one of the topics that people are really interested in right now, which is we care greatly about having diverse individuals on our team, and yet we're not getting some of these diverse individuals to speak and share their ideas. And how do we do this? And I think it's at least 50% of the equation that gets missed in this topic. Like, okay, you can bring in someone who's a first generation from Nigeria. You could bring in someone who has never graduated high school, but is brilliant and has created these amazing code books that are being used by massive packages by Adobe and Google. So when you bring them in, they're going to be intimidated. And so how do you create a social environment such that you're not tokenizing them? You are viewing them as someone that has unique information, and we're going to tend to that more than what our commonalities are. And what most mistakes people make are in leadership positions and groups in general, including sports teams, is that we are going to see where a camaraderie lies, where we have harmony, where there's positivity. And what I help them do is realize, as long as you create new norms where you're focusing on criticality because we care about good decision-making, disagreement because we want to make sure we get all of the errors and mistakes in the room before we actually bring it to our stakeholders, and we want to focus on autonomy as opposed to trying to get people to agree with you, you can have amazing things occur.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I can see how that would resonate in a big corporate setting, bringing a diverse group of people into an organization versus bringing the diverse perspectives out of them once they're there.
Right.
I think that's pretty cool. And you spend a lot of time, obviously, talking about diversity. You focus on individuality. But continuing with the enigma of your life, while you talk about individuality, you're not really one of a kind. You're actually one of two. You're a twin. And I don't want to just blow past that as an interesting anecdote, because you're actually the very first twin, to my knowledge, to appear on Datages. And I actually want to explore that just a little bit.
Sure.
And understand how being a twin and having that experience growing up, especially through your developmental years, how that shapes and frames your perspective about these kinds of concepts and the topics that you spend so much time talking about.
So just to make sure I put my flag in for no one's going to take my stature on Datages, I'm also a twin with twins. So we go two generations.
Yeah.
So I'm getting this firsthand, secondhand.
That's like a 4x4, isn't it?
Yeah. And no one goes that far in terms of their keynote speeches. Yeah. I mean, one of the big things about twins, I see this firsthand and now secondhand with my girls, is you try to look for what is going to be your personal territory that you're going to be known for and identified with. And so for my twin brother and I, who's incredibly smart, much better than me on the GREs, much better than me on SATs and grades. I remember he was reading Battlefield Earth at age 11, which ignored the Dianetics and the bizarre sci-fi cult aspects of this. It's like a 1500 page book.
Yeah.
I was out there playing.
That's impressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So he grabbed the mantle of I'm the intelligent one quickly. And so what you do as a twin is figure out what's left for me in terms of to get some stature where people will actually like me, adore me, love me, give me some affection. And for me, it was bizarre, creative thinking. And so I started really early being performing and writing and, people, there are cousins of mine that talk about how, I knew you were going to be a writer at age 9. Because that was like my thing in my twindom.
And you made sure you were going to be the individual despite what genetics may have indicated.
Well, that's another interesting facet. So I'll tell you some, for those listeners who have kids, even though we look nothing alike, I have blue-green eyes, my brother has brown eyes, I work out, my brother decided not to lift a weight, I've gone out in the sun, my brother looks like he's one of, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, extra characters. We have our birthmarks and moles are mirror images of each other. So if we died in a car accident, you could figure out who is who. And our teeth are exactly the same in terms of if you got a dental imprint from an orthodontist. So there's some weird things.
Left mole, right mole, and a winning smile.
Yeah. So, but most people, when they hear twin, their brains fog up and they do not see any differences. So a lot of times people think we're identical until they look at a picture later when they're not in twin mode.
That's great. Got to look deeper. You know, speaking of looking deeper, you know, on a very personal note, looking further at your family of origin, you shared that you and your brother grew up without a father in your life, talked about the role that your mother played in your life in encouraging and embracing insubordination. And then she was taken from you very early in life. And you shared in your book that you were then raised by your grandmother, and you dedicated the book to those two women in particular and the impact that they had on your life. Can you share some more about that background and the special role that those two women played in your life and in developing some of these perspectives that have become so fundamental to you?
I'm glad you're bringing this up, because we are at a cultural point right now where people are obsessing over children's need for a two-parent family. And I would argue that, like most things, there are heterogeneous outcomes that come from particular family households. So if you have a single parent that is fully invested and providing all that nurturance and that secure base that you can come to when you're distressed. So we grew up in a neighborhood that was 95% Black, which means we were the minorities. We were the ones that had to code switch, my twin brother and I. And when you grow up in a, you know, a rough, lower income neighborhood that we were in, your mom or primary caregiver is a very important character. We got bullied quite a bit. And my mom always tried to help us figure out, okay, how could you physically defend yourselves? How could you psychologically use jujitsu and actually get out of very difficult situations? And then who are your allies in our neighborhood that you can come to if I'm not home or I'm not there? So she helped us be very situationally aware, knowing she was working two jobs. There, like you said, we didn't have a father figure growing up. And for us to basically take advantage of, what social resources do we have at our disposal? And I think people that are well off, whether that's, you know, a really well-to-do family, financially, socially integrated, you got a lot of family that's available there, you may not develop these skills that people like myself have, who had to grow up in partial families, where we, this disadvantage becomes an advantage in terms of, you know, we understand what's available to us, what's not, what do we have to work towards, and how much sweat equity we're willing to commit because we know we need to.
Fascinating. And so you don't look at not having a father or a male father figure role model in your life as being something that you missed. It was an opportunity for you to fill that gap and grow into that absence and take on those traits yourself as you developed. Am I getting that about right?
I would say both these things are true.
Yeah.
If I had my time machine to go back, I would love to have had a male role model in my life who was there to help me, you know, learn sports in a more efficient manner of actually playing with me outside, learning how to catch a ball, how to wrestle somebody, you know, what a lacrosse stick, how you actually move it. All of those things, even like changing a tire on my car when I was 16.
Of course.
I remember turning to my friend Martin and saying, listen, this is an awkward question. It's hard for a 16-year-old, much less a 35-year-old, to say, I have no idea how to go into the hood of a car and what's in there. And then he took me to, you know, a local park at nighttime, and we spent like 3-4 hours, and he taught me everything he knows about cars. And you, it would have been, it is the most inefficient trial and error approach to grow as a person, but I wouldn't want to reverse what led me to here now. But I think for people listening to this is to realize is that you have an opportunity to be that character, stand-in character for someone that doesn't have, the father might not be there, but the father might be there and be absent, which is even worse than not having a father.
And this is, you're a fellow intellectual, so this isn't over-intellectualizing when I say it to you. What we really try to focus on at Datages, it kind of makes us unique from what I think you'd find in other platforms, generally speaking, is we really focus on the generational transference of knowledge and wisdom, understanding how it is our backgrounds and the influences in our lives shape who we are and what we do today, and then how we pass that on. And so you kind of see that structure to everything we do. I'm fascinated by what you do, but I'm even more fascinated in how you got there.
That's great. That's what people want, need, should get.
So Todd, let's now, you know, turn our attention to your latest book, The Art of Insubordination. Got my copy right here. You know, I really love this book, and so many of the things that you talk about from the get-go are really aligned with topics that we cover a lot here on Datages. You know, it starts with the datage that is the foundation for this episode, to thine own self be true. And obviously insubordination and dissent, those things feed right into those topics that we've talked about. But I'm excited to get into some of the other more subtle messages within the book that relate to some things that I've covered here on Datages as well. And I'd love to bounce some ideas off one another as we go through. But one of the things that I talk about with my audience, with the Datages friends and family, there's this trite expression of, you've got to think outside the box. And my response is, I've never even seen the box. And, you know, what I really loved about your book is you go way beyond that. Maybe you can help explain for the Datages friends and family what insubordination really means, how powerful it can be, and why it's not enough to just think outside the box.
Yeah. No, I like that you're going past the colloquial phrases. I mean, the way to think about society is it's a bunch of cultural artifacts, norms, rituals, and then institutions. And so if you break it down into those categories, you can see is there is a lot of inertia to follow through with the things as they are. So just think of, you've got mandatory education, which is great that it exists, kindergarten and 12th grade, and it's illegal to have your kids not doing that. Within that structure, we rarely question of, to what degree would we, if we were starting from scratch, how would we design the education system? So I just wrote an article in my Substack about some new research on ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which shows that if you have this condition, which is really about working memory deficits, hard to put information that you're processing into a reservoir that you're going to retain it, you find that physical movement is fantastic for you to move things from working memory to short-term memory to long-term memory, and you're better extemporaneously having conversations like this on the fly where you have no idea what the other person's going to say. But what's interesting, if you use the same strategies of having those physio balls in the classroom, maybe having conversations while you're walking around the playground, maybe asking questions. If I get a free throw in, I get to ask the teacher a question. If she gets it in, then she gets to ask me a question. All that works for kids with this condition, but not people who don't have these conditions. It actually interferes with their learning. What I love about that finding is we have to stop thinking about one size fits all approaches. And this is where dissent comes in a very healthy, natural way of saying, hey, I know this person is a little bit different. I'm a little bit different here. I have some questions and I have some thoughts about how to improve things. And those little tiny tinkerings are the seeds that get to the guy in the suitcase in Tiananmen Square or Alexei Navalny. These are the small micro behaviors that are emblematic of those profound dissenters.
Amazing. And can you explain a little bit more how dissent is so fundamental and important to humankind?
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you an example of, I was doing some consultation with the Green Bay Packers in Wisconsin, and they were having a meeting where there was a lot, people are up in arms about, and if you know, this is a professional football team. People are up in arms because they were deciding to support the LGBTQ community with rainbow flags. Now, this is Wisconsin. I'm from New York. They're different subcultures. So there was an ex Hall of Fame player of the Green Bay Packers, won't name him, who was saying, you know, I was one of them. And then I went to church and now I'm not. Now I'm straight. And I think that it is an anathema, like it is the wrong thing for this organization to support what God doesn't support. Now, it doesn't matter where you stand on this issue. I realize this is a third rail here that I'm bringing up here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's what we're all about here. We're not about political correctness. We're about talking about real life and real issues.
So you could imagine if you're there, people are shocked. And, you know, this is like, this is not Mr. Congeniality. You said the thing that people are thinking that you're not supposed to say in a large room. Here's what I would say based on the science and what happened in that meeting. Let's say you find his comment to be homophobic, wrong, problematic, does not matter. What it led to was a conversation of, as a professional athletic team, what do we make as our decision rule for which causes we support and which ones we don't? And that conversation never really took place. And this dissenting voice, agree or disagree with him, led to this conversation. What do we do about domestic violence? What do we do about poverty? What do we do about the minimum wages in our community happening? What do we do about gentrification of the sprawling prices of rentals in our neighborhood? They can't support everything because then they support nothing that happens there. And there was no process for them to think why this issue and not those other issues. And that is the liberating effect of a dissenter.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it's interesting how you talk about just one moment of dissent on one highly controversial topic serving as the catalyst for opening up all of these topics that are so important for discussion. And it reminds me of a debate that I recently viewed back at Stanford 2 weekends ago. And it was Dean Deborah Satz, the Dean of the School of Humanities and Sciences, and Condoleezza Rice. And the two of them don't see eye to eye on many what are considered political issues, conservative versus liberal type things. But what they did agree upon is that this notion that language and discussion and bringing up certain sensitive topics is producing harm for individuals is really a damaging notion. That if you really look at it, did something that someone say harm you, or did it just offend you and shake you to your core, to where it opened you up to being able to talk about these things? And I think that that's so important to our society, and particularly important in higher education, your environment in which you operate, to be able to have those kinds of challenging discussions. Because if you close the door on it because you're afraid to offend somebody, you're never going to get anywhere. And you're going to destroy some of the last places that remain in our society for that kind of open discourse and academic freedom.
Yeah, just take an extension. Condoleezza Rice is a perfect example of a very effective conservative dissenter who's, and she is blessed by her demographics, allow her to be heard more than if someone looked like me or you in this regard. You have to ask questions such as, if you meet people who are into QAnon and Pizzagate and conspiracy theorists, where do you want them to get retrained? Like, where do you want them to get educated? And what happens if you decide you're going to close all the doors to all the channels of the universities and the educational systems, and so they go underground? And so for me, whatever the election is, for whatever presidential office, I make a statement for the university, sometimes getting into arguments with the president of George Mason University, saying, whoever we think is an extremist, I want them in my classroom. I want them in the classrooms because I want them to hear why their views are considered wrong or off guard to some people. Those people might be right or wrong in their thinking, and have a facilitator, a teacher, professor that says, hey, so we've heard two different views right here. Let's look for cognitive biases that might exist on both of these sides. Let's name them. Let's discuss them. And so now you go from the initial content itself, just like that Hall of Fame player bringing up of, we shouldn't be supporting, you know, gay rights. And now we've actually moved into really meaningful desire to hear what it is about the human brain, what it is about the need to be social and feel like you're part of a group, that you're willing to disagree with truth and reality, put it aside because you care too much about being a secure position within a group.
It's a good segue to what I want to talk about next, because you're talking about meaning, and you're talking about not just the notion of insubordination, but the motivation behind that insubordination. And you introduce a concept in the book, principled insubordination. I'm married to a woman who is half Lebanese and half Filipina, so I know all about dissent and argument for the sake of argument and nothing more. What is it that makes principled dissent so much more important and more valuable than just simply being difficult?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised this, because it's easy to think of, and I purposely chose the term insubordination because in the military, you get punished and vilified for you went out of command, out of order to speak about something. And what I would argue, which is, and Chad, you've been saying this all along, is this is a problematic approach to take that military language and integrate that into society such that a kid can't speak out of turn because they're obey your elders, honor thy mother and thy father here. And I would say you are probably having a problematic job of raising an independent, critical mind, critical thinking adult if you abide too rigidly to the belief that you don't disagree with your parents. Now, are those kids going to get the majority of the things wrong in terms of what they say? Absolutely. Are they going to phrase it in the wrong manner? No question about it. But our job is to shape them, not to make them passive vehicles that are going to be mistreated and abused and ignored by people in society. And so principled insubordination, one of the key elements in there is trying to make a contribution with your ideas, your thoughts, or your decision-making. And that piece there is that I'm not doing this to get attention. I'm not doing this to look intelligent. There's no self-presentation bias. It's just that it's bothering me that wrongful, harmful, misguided ideas and decisions are taking precedence. That's really a fundamental piece that goes from unprincipled to principled.
And that's where we will pause for today, Dadage's friends and family. Don't miss the second half of this interview with Todd Kashtan, where we will geek out about his book and talk about several key principles in The Art of Insubordination that are directly tied to some of our past dadages. Until then, remember, Dad may not always know what he's talking about, but he sure can sound like he does.